Hey guys, this is Ariana Mendez from Ride Owl Politics coming to you from Miami. So today is our first bonus episode and I'm really excited. So basically a bonus episode is going to be more of a one-on-one conversation between you and me. It's going to be a little bit different from our regular episode in the sense that the regular episode that airs every Friday is going to be a longer episode. We're going to deep dive into some political issues. It's going to be, you know, an awesome guest with me discussing, having those real conversations. So that is a little bit more structured, if you will, than what this episode is going to be. This episode and the episodes in the future that are called bonus episodes will be more about you getting to know me. And you can send in questions, you can be part of this conversation. And why did we decide here at Ride Owl that a bonus episode was necessary? Because honestly, if I was in your shoes, I would want to know a little bit more about me. I'm not a, you know, household name. I don't have a show on Fox. I don't have a show on CNN. I seem to be just this random person that came out of nowhere and decided, hey, I'm going to launch a podcast. And by the way, you should listen because. And I don't think that's fair. And if I was in your shoes, I would be like wondering, okay, I have only a limited amount of time, a limited amount of down hours where I'm not working, I'm not taking care of the kids, I'm not going to school. Why should I carve out a few hours of my day to listen to this random woman on this podcast? What is it for me? Why should I care what she thinks? And for me, that's a valid question. Why should you care? And these bonus episodes are for you to get to know me better, understand my values, understand my background, and also my opinion on things that maybe don't really fit into the regular Friday episode format. And it's a more of a casual conversation. I'll try to keep it as a shorter episode. And I think it's a really great opportunity. And I don't have any type of preference with the topics. Maybe you can, you know, send in messages as far as what the topic should be, or I can ask you guys for feedback. But at the end of the day, I just want this to be a conversation, more casual, more, you know, let's get coffee, you and I, and just discuss random things, something that would interest you and would make you feel more comfortable, more at ease, about listening to this podcast and more intrigued to learn my opinion. So it's an awesome opportunity to be able to sit in front of a microphone. It's also a great responsibility. So, and yeah, I get it. That sounded like this, you know, Spider-Man quote. Got it. But there's truth to that. And the fact that I had the balls, if you will, to sit at a microphone and think that I have a right or I'm important enough to share my opinions, well, that means I have some explaining to do. Why do I think that? So with that said, we're going to jump into what I'm calling a Q&A. And it's going to be more about what motivated me to start this podcast and how that is also part of that motivation was what I think was the greatest mistake I ever made. So without further ado, let's jump right in. So a lot of you send in questions for this Q&A, and I am so grateful for that, so thank you. And there was one question that I thought was extremely interesting, but I also felt that that question was connected to the question of what motivated me to start my own podcast. And those two questions, what motivated me to start my own podcast and what was the biggest mistake I've ever made, are interconnected. So instead of trying to, you know, in a shorter period of time, deep dive 7 to 8 questions, I think I'm going to stick to those two questions and do an episode on that, because answering those two questions will give you a very good insight of who I am as a person and what my values are and why I'm sitting behind this microphone right now. So, what motivated me to start this podcast? Well, in order to understand that, we have to go back to 1950s Cuba. And my parents are Cuban. and they fled Cuba, trying to escape Castro's communist regime. Now, my mom had had a visa to come to the United States since she was 7 or 8 years old. But my mom's family was blacklisted, meaning they were targeted and the government kept a watchful eye on them. And it was very bad. She had this visa since she was a little girl and she was not allowed to leave the country. She was not allowed to leave Cuba to go directly to the United States. So my mom was forced to stay in Cuba. And when I'm telling you that these were very bad times, they were. My family on my mom's side, just like my dad's side, were targeted. Their businesses were targeted. My mother was called all sorts of names, including whore, prostitute, worm, you know, the famous gusano, as they would call them, just because her family was not supportive of the Castro regime. And all their property was nationalized. They were left in complete poverty. Now, my parents and their families weren't extraordinarily wealthy before Castro, but they were comfortably upper middle class. From one day to another, that was completely destroyed. All that wealth, all that prosperity, all that progress. Because we need to remember, our current state, our current status is built on past generations' victories, successes, and sacrifices. So when you take a family and you take away everything from them, you are destroying the legacy of their ancestors. So that's what happened to my parents. Their family's legacy was destroyed and they were left in complete poverty. And simply because it fit into the communist objective. And the political persecution was horrible. They would throw rotten vegetables, rotten eggs at the houses of Cubans who did not support the Castro regime. And that was kind of the environment my mom grew up in. And she eventually meets my dad, and my dad had gone through similar experiences. His family did not support the Castro regime. My dad often tells me the story of him being on his family's farm, and in the middle of the night, Castro's police knock on their door, asking for weapons, farm machinery, and any food that they had on hand. And my dad is sitting there, he's 15 years old, and terrified, just completely terrified that they would kill his father, kill him, and do whatever it was to his sister and mother. That's the kind of environment my parents grew up on. Not to mention that any dreams of having a career or, you know, having what their parents had, you know, promised them that they would be able to have was completely destroyed when Fidel Castro came into power. So my parents meet, they get married, they have my sister. And shortly thereafter, they make it a point that they want to leave Cuba. And they didn't want to leave Cuba because they didn't have anything to eat. They wanted to leave Cuba because literally they could not continue living under such horrible conditions. And when I mean horrible, the fact that you couldn't even express an opinion because somebody, you know, the local Communist Party chapter was gonna, you know, go and tell the authorities that you had said something that maybe could be interpreted as anti-Castro. And since everybody knew that you weren't a communist, you being, you know, my parents, they were constantly under watchful eye. It was horrible conditions to raise a family, and it is the worst condition that a human being could live in, that you cannot even express a point of view. So my parents decided we're going to leave, and we're going to leave wherever they will allow us to go. So they couldn't go directly to the United States because Cuba would not let my mom leave directly to the United States. So eventually they got a visa to Venezuela. They arrive in Venezuela with the clothes on their back. My sister is very young. And my dad starts working to save up enough money to leave Venezuela and travel to the United States. My parents eventually save up enough money and they're able to buy plane tickets to California. In California, my mom had family and it seemed like the ideal choice. My parents arrive, my dad is sick, he needs medical attention, and he has to undergo an operation. So imagine that, you just arrived to this country, you don't know the language, you don't have a job, and my dad needs to go to a hospital because he is in a serious health condition. He has a serious health condition and needs an operation because it's that bad. So my parents, right off the gate, they're in debt up to their eyeballs because of medical bills. And my mom starts to work at a chili factory. She gets up every day at 4 a.m., takes care of my sister, you know, gets her ready for the day, drops her off at a babysitter that costs half of her weekly wages, to then get on a bus and travel to the chili factory and start packaging chili. That's what my mom is doing right when she gets to America. At that time, my dad is still convalescent, can't work, and they are up to their eyeballs in debt because of my dad's medical bills. My mom is, like I said, half of her wages every week go to the babysitter. And she's on the bus, a woman, alone, every day at 4:30 a.m. and comes back home at 8 o'clock at night. That's my parents' life. Eventually, my dad gets better. He starts working at a furniture store. And slowly, their life starts to improve. But it's difficult. But I always hear this story from my parents. They were so happy. They didn't care about the difficulty. My mom didn't care about having to, ride the bus at 4:30 in the morning because she was at least free. She could talk to somebody about what she believed in and didn't have to fear that she was going to be thrown in jail for saying that she disagreed with something. That for her was being a millionaire. The right to be able to express herself made her feel like she was a millionaire. That's incredible. So years go by, 14 years after I'm born, and my mom has me, and she is older in life. She's in her 40s, and times are different. They're not as, they're not as poor as they were when they arrived, and life is good. All things considered, life is good. But from the moment I opened my eyes, politics was a part of my family culture. So every Sunday, my mom would host a big dinner at the house, and all my uncles and cousins would come. And it was a great environment. A lot of commotion, a lot of laughter, a lot of conversation. But I have this image of my father sitting around the dinner table with my uncles and my aunts. And you saw this great dynamic where you had these men that were drinking Cuban coffee and just, you know, spending hours discussing about politics. And that was the environment I grew up in. By the time I was 6 years old, I knew who Fidel Castro was. I knew he was bad, and I knew that he had done something really bad to our family. And in my family, politics was the conversation at the dinner table every day. My dad would sit and say, "Hey, Ariana, did you hear about this? Did you hear about that?" He would explain to me countries. He would explain to me the history of countries. Because although my father didn't go to college, he was a person that desired knowledge. He read the newspaper, he listened to news, he listened to the radio. He was a person that seeked out knowledge because that knowledge was deprived, was prohibited to him when he lived in Cuba. So that knowledge that was prohibited was something now that he could openly seek out. And he wanted to make sure that I understood that that was something that I was fortunate to have. The availability of facts, of information, of news was something that not everybody in the world had. So I grew up with that culture of you need to be informed, you need to know your stuff, you need to know your history. So by the time I'm in high school, I am a political junkie. I love politics. I love the history. The first campaign that I volunteered in was McCain Palin. And I was kind of a weird kid. I watched Fox News every day. I read every book I could get my hands on about politics. And my room was a shrine to the founding fathers, Margaret Thatcher, and Ronald Reagan. No boy bands, nothing like that. It was founding fathers, Margaret Thatcher, and Ronald Reagan. I was that type of kid. So I really, really felt, you know, a sense of duty that I needed to do something to protect this country, because not only had this country given my parents an opportunity to make a new life, it was going to give me an opportunity that millions of people around the world would want to have, to be able to go to college, to be able to pursue my dreams, because I believed, and I still do, that this is the only country that gives you truly the opportunity to make your dreams a reality. So I felt this sense of patriotism and duty, because there is a debt of gratitude I carry. And to this day, I feel so compelled to be grateful to this country for opening their arms to my parents. Because without that, my parents would have been stuck in Venezuela. And we all know what has happened to Venezuela in recent years. Because when freedom dies here, that's it. There's nowhere else to go. This is the last stand. So my first campaign was McCain Palin. And it was really an extraordinary experience. I could not vote for McCain, but I did knock on doors and, call voters at the phone bank and did my due diligence to make sure he was elected. Obviously, we were not as fortunate. We were not successful at all, but it was a good opportunity, and it was my first campaign, and I remember it fondly. From then on, I graduated, I went into college, I was a political science major, and on college, I really went out of my way to be, you know, that annoying conservative voice on campus. I was the student in the class full of liberals raising my hand and making the conservative arguments, because I believed, and I still believe, in a strong military, free markets, small government, and, you know, common sense approach to things. And I don't believe we should have equality of results. If quality of opportunity is great, and I think everybody needs to have equal access, but at some point, it depends on you. It depends on your output. It depends on your willingness to work and get it done. So I was that voice in the room. And honestly, sometimes it was hard. Not everybody liked my opinions, but at that time, it was a different political climate. I had great friends on the other side of the aisle, and my professors, who were liberals, still respected me for my opinions. I don't think that's the climate we live in today. And later on in my postgraduate career, I understood that the climate was different, and it was really quite damaging. But we'll get to that in a second. So I was that voice in the room. I was that, you know, elephant in the room, if you will. And I loved it. I was president of the Political Science Club. I got to do events that really brought more of both sides to the conversation. I was the student coordinator for Constitution Day at school, which means I got to put American flags wherever I wanted. And it was great. It really was a great experience. I still look back at my undergraduate years as the best years of my education. It was great. I had lots of fun. I was started to write articles and opinion pieces for Women's Voices magazine, and from a millennial conservative perspective. And it was great. And then I moved on to another magazine to write about politics, Biz Catalyst. And it was just wonderful time. It was a great time. And then I graduated in 2014, and I decided that I wanted to get, before I went to law school, I wanted to get a political science degree, a master's. And I went, and again, I found a very welcoming environment. All my professors were liberal, but there was still, you know, a willingness to have a conversation and were interested in listening. And I found that environment so welcoming. And during that time that I was getting my master's, I also got married, and I found a great guy and my husband, Chris, and we shared similar values. Our families had gone through similar things back in Cuba, and he has served in the military, so I had great admiration for him and for the sacrifices he had made for this country. So we were just a good match on that front. So I was a very political person. I was a member of the Republican Party of Miami-Dade. I was helping campaigns. I was doing editorials. Like, politics was a really important part of my life, and I cannot overstate that. I spoke about politics every day. I, you know, lived it every day. It was my hobby. It was my daily activity. I did school politics, and that was, you know, that was my thing. So I had always wanted to be a lawyer, even when I was a little girl, because I admired the fact that lawyers were like the gatekeepers to justice. And my mother, you know, this is gonna be this is gonna be funny. My mother was a big fan of Law and Order, you know, the original Law and Order. And she would watch the Law and Order shows dubbed in Spanish. And I remember being a little girl and just being fascinated every time, you know, the lawyer came on the TV. Eventually that translated that I would arrange my Barbie dolls as a jury. And, you know, Ken was always on trial for stealing the sandwich. And Ken always was found guilty. And he was always sentenced to death for stealing the sandwich. And I think my mom has pictures of that somewhere. But just to give you an idea that this desire to be an attorney was really something ingrained in me from an early age. But I never thought being an attorney and loving politics were something that were mutually exclusive. I thought that I could use my skills as an attorney to be a proponent for my values and for the causes I believe in. Because justice, you know, strong criminal accountability, having criminal justice reform that makes sense, that doesn't encourage recidivism but discourages it, all of that was, you know, in line with, you know, my political point of views and also my desire to help society. So even though I went to get a master's in political science, and I wanted to do that because I just love this stuff, it was fascinating. My thesis was on how rhetoric can alienate certain voters, and that was a fascinating study, and I created, you know, a lot of different measurements for that, and I had a great time doing that. So here I have all these political skill sets, all these different experiences, and I say, okay, I'm going to go to law school. And I was really excited because this is what I always wanted to do. At this time, I was still studying, or I should say I was still writing opinion pieces. And, you know, I was a Trump supporter in 2016 when being a Trump supporter was a four-letter word. So imagine going into law school, which, little to my knowledge, apparently a difference of opinion is not encouraged, and walking into a classroom of first-year law school students that hated Trump, hated everything he stood for, who started following me on social media only to discover that, oh boy, she's a conservative. And I remember having a lot of interesting conversations that first semester of law school, and all of them started off, well, do you even have a reason for supporting Trump? Can you even articulate a reason why you support Trump? Or how can you even support Trump? You're such a racist. So this was the kind of environment that I stepped into my first year. And honestly, it was horrible. I had never felt this before. I felt targeted for being a conservative. And mind you, I had been to undergrad. I had been that elephant in the room for all 4 years. Then I went to a graduate school for political science. And I was like, hey, this is cool. Like, everybody's here liberal, but they're willing to listen to me and have those debates. I like it here. At least they pretended to, you know? They gave it the old college try, if you will. These people, and hey, I have a lot of love for them as my classmates, and we went through hell and back in our first and second semester of law school. But these people were very critical. These people made me feel bad. These people bullied me because I was a conservative. And I remember having a discussion before civil procedure one morning with one of my classmates. And this guy was like, how can you even vote for Trump? Do you even have a reason for voting for Trump? And I did. I actually laid it out. And just the environment in that room turned ice cold. People overhearing the conversation. It was like, oh, you like Trump? Racist. And mind you, this is law school. We're supposed to be people that can give you both sides of an argument. We're supposed to be very open-minded. We're attorneys. We're supposed to be able to strategically place ourselves in a situation and evaluate it from both sides. With that in mind, it was fascinating. It was fascinating to hear, I don't think your opinion is valid. Like, you either had two options. You were center left or you were left. Those were the two spectrums you were allowed. And that was the same vibe from professors. The comments made about President Trump, his supporters, it was a very isolating environment. So, first semester of law school goes, goes along, and I continue to pump out my opinion pieces, and one of them predicted the electoral victory of Donald Trump. And you know, I promoted that on social media. And these people had, when I say these people, my classmates had, you know, this very strong reaction. And when I say strong reaction, I'm understating it. It was just vitriolic. It was hateful. It was, how can you? You racist. You shouldn't even be here. I've never felt this before. So at some point, you know, you realize that there are some conservatives in that group, but we didn't come out to each other's defense. They would never come out in my defense, and they would just, you know, try to survive. And surviving meaning that you play along with the other liberals, just so that you're not the target of their hatred. So I was basically, you know, on my own. For the first time in my educational career, I felt like I was an ugly duckling, undeserving of anybody's friendship, attention, because everybody knew I was a conservative, and that was reason enough to just target me and disregard my very existence and actually hate me. It was that bad that they actually hated me because I was a conservative. So for the first time in my life, like, let's put this in perspective. Remember I said that my parents had always told me, you live in this country and we're so grateful that this country has all these liberties. For the first time in my life, I had like a 2% taste of what my parents must have gone through in Cuba under the communist dictatorship. Being targeted, not because they were doing something bad or they were stealing or breaking the law. No. They were being targeted because of their political point of view. And in that moment in my life, we're talking 2016, in good old USA, I was being targeted by my peers and by professors because of my political point of view. That's heavy stuff. And like I said, it's never to your face. It's never directly. It's more of an environment. It's this vibe you get that you're unwelcome, and they'll say snide remarks and they'll do all sorts of things to try to handicap you. That's the environment in my first and second semester of law school. And at one point I met with a counselor, and somehow this person knew that I was, you know, a conservative political activist and I was heavily involved in politics. And believe it or not, this person actually told me, and this comes to the biggest mistake I made in my life. She tells me, I think you need to hide the political stuff from your background. That's not going to be good for your legal career. Attorneys are a very liberal group, and if they knew you're a conservative, you are going to be targeted. And she talks about then about my article being great and she wished she could share it with the school, but she knows if she shares my latest political article, I'm going to be targeted by professors because that's just the way things are. So I did what she told me to do, and that was probably the biggest mistake of my life. I scrubbed my social media of anything conservative. I stopped posting about conservative things. I dedicated myself to just going to school, going to class, not talking to anybody, just living this mindless existence of going to school, doing my work, and not having even a personality. Because my personality was so political in many ways because I had such strong opinions, that I basically had to shut my very essence down, create a different version of myself so that I could survive in this law school environment and that I could prosper. Because if I dared to express an opinion that was contrary to the mob mentality, I was going to pay a price. They were going to target me. And I did that. And yeah, I survived law school. I graduated. I got awards, all that good stuff. I did well academically. But yeah, the only price I had to pay was, you know, I don't want to be dramatic about it, but it was a piece of who I am. I am a political person. I have strong opinions. I grew up being told you can express your opinion here freely without judgment, without fear of consequences. You have that right. You are free here. And then I step into an environment, and to a certain degree, this was my first taste of the profession that tells me, no, you have no right to express anything. If you don't agree with the herd, you're going to be targeted and eliminated. And it was very sad. And I'm not telling you everybody was like that, but the vast majority was. So fast forward, I graduate law school. I become an attorney. And I'm like, I'm at a juncture in my life. I don't have to be scared of these people anymore. I don't have to worry about them targeting me. If they don't like me, go fly a kite. Honestly, I don't care. I'm a Republican, I'm a conservative, and I have a voice, and I have opinions, and I've always had opinions, and I'm going to continue to have these opinions. And by the way, I don't have to worry. What can you do to me now? Can you target me? Oh, yeah, good luck with that. I finally had the power to be myself again. I finally had the power to say, stop. Stop, you're not going to control me like that. Yes, I have all this training, all this knowledge, all this expertise, but I'm my own person. I am who I am. So imagine being so frustrated and being so sad that you couldn't even express who you were through 3 years of your life. And then finally, you have a eureka moment and you're like, yeah, I'm done. So it's really interesting. And I feel like a lot of people need to come and think about priorities and how your life is going to go, because you only have one chance and you only have one life to live. And I choose to live my life to the fullest. And I choose to express myself in every sense of the word. So it's important to me to come on here and share that with you. That story, not many people know about it. And not even my parents for a long time knew how oppressed I felt in that environment for 3 years. And coming on here and telling you that is liberating, because now it's on the record. I've shared the story. I have articulated it. I am free of it, and it's control that it has over me. And that's the kind of conversation that I want to have on this show every week. Just a one-to-one conversation about what we truly care about, how it makes us feel, because it's not easy for me. Remember, I told you this whole story of how I was raised to, you know, always express yourself, stand up for what you believe in, and have that backbone. And then going through a three-year process where I was basically shut down. My light was turned off. And I'm telling you this, if there's anybody out there that's going through a similar thing, that destroys you. You're not the same person. You lose your spark. You lose that thing that makes you you. And this podcast is not about me. It's about sharing ideas and really going to the nitty-gritty about things that usually we wouldn't discuss because we fear, you know, social judgment. And that's why I decided to launch this podcast when I did. Because I was tired of the fear-mongering. I was tired of the misinformation. And I know the tactics that are used because, believe it or not, I was never the receiving end of those tactics by my peers, by people that I should respect, because those tactics are not just in the political realm. We see them in every facet of society. So, and I'm not trying to say that my school was bad. I think that just it was the perfect storm of people at that point in time that made my experience not as enjoyable as it should have been. Besides all of the stresses that come with law school, I also had to deal with that. So I felt that that was an important story to share, and that was my greatest mistake, allowing this person to influence the way that I was going to act, to allow them to tell me that I needed to shut down a part of myself. That was my biggest mistake. But that mistake has now turned into a huge opportunity to undo all that damage that those 3 years did to me. Because now I have this microphone and I can make up for 3 years of silence. Because I am here, I'm ready to be part of the fight. So let's rock and roll. Let's do this. Let's make a difference. Let's be part of the conversation. Well, guys, before I sign off, I don't want to forget to mention that tomorrow we have a really interesting conversation with our guest, Gina Sosa, on the double standard of the media and the left on sexual allegations against Joe Biden. And we're going to really go through, you know, a comparison of how Brett Kavanaugh supporters were treated versus how people who support Joe Biden during his sex scandal are being treated by the left and the press. It's going to be a good show, so don't miss it. Tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern Standard Time, the new episode goes live on wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for joining us. And remember, this is Right Owl Politics.